We'll go ahead and get started. First, welcome to Mainstreamers, and we're about halfway through just what's been a really terrific year in Mainstreamers. Thank you for being here. Just love to see y'all having moments of fellowship beforehand. That's really what this is about. We hopefully each couple weeks to bring you a really compelling presentation. But I just love that you're all here and that you're connecting with one another. As I always say, kind of creating and weaving that social fabric in and out of each other's lives here at South Main. And it's just wonderful that you're here. Where our meal is being prepared, and so we're going to have a great meal. And when we do serve that, we'll go over the prayer concerns and the birthdays as well. Hopefully, maybe Carrie will come down here to sing. If not, Brad will. So we'll be in good
for
shape.
For a price.
Yeah, that's right. So, but again, thank you for being here. I know that today in particular, you're going to enjoy this program with Brad. I hope that you're getting to know the staff just a little bit more. Well, you kind of get a piece of our lives here at church, but hopefully introducing you into a little bit deeper understanding of who everybody is. So again, thanks for being here, and we will go ahead and get started. Brad Jernberg is here today, and you're going to learn a little bit about Brad. Why don't you start us off, just tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of where and how you grew up. Maybe a little bit about your family, your parents, your sister. Just kind of get us started.
I was born in Dallas, Texas. Don't hold it against me. Dallas and Houston are natural rivals, although I find that they are very, very similar. It's just that Houston is three times as big. But they're pretty much the same city. Lived in... Do what? I didn't know we were getting audience feedback this early in today. That was not in my contract, Counselor Funderburk. Parents still live in the same house that we were born into, so we grew up in the Lake Highlands area of Dallas. If you're at all familiar with that, I went to Lake Highlands High School. My dad is a now retired ER doctor. He was the head of the emergency department at Baylor Medical Center Garland for 42 years. Mom is a teacher by training and raised us as we grew up, and mom and dad have both taught children's Sunday school at Wilshire Baptist Church for 38 or 39 years now, first grade Sunday school. My sister is a pastor. She's the pastor of Calvary Baptist Church in Denver, Colorado, where she just marked her 10th anniversary there. And she's really, really doing well, and she's a phenomenal preacher. So that's a little bit about my background.
I heard your sister, does your sister get up early in the morning to do her sermons, to prepare her sermons?
Yeah, she, Anne's pattern, my sister's name is Anne, with an E. Anne's pattern is to sort of ruminate on the text and the sermon all week long, follow the news, follow what's happening in Denver, follow the pulse of her congregation, and then wake up about 2 a.m. on Sunday and write it before she preaches it at, 8 a.m.
It's a high wire act.
I have counseled her that is not a pattern for a long career in ministry work, but it seems to work for her for now, so...
It's always good to have your parents down here. They seem like just wonderful, wonderful people. And that connection with Wilshire, our church has so many connections with Wilshire. Well, what were your earliest memories? Did you grow up at Wilshire in particular?
I did, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about growing up at Wilshire, some of your earliest memories of church and that sort of thing.
My earliest memory of church, which is actually my earliest actual memory, is sometime between the ages of 2 and 3. I found out I was allergic to peanuts at church. So this was while big church was going on. The three-year-olds were kept in what you all remember as extended session. Remember when we called it extended session? I was sitting in extended session playing with a wooden train, and the snack was crackers and peanut butter that day. And I ate, and in about 5 minutes felt really weird and then just vomited all over the place and was sort of scared. My dad, back in those days, played the piano for the services, and so they went and got dad off the piano bench and said, something's wrong with Brad. And so I was tested and then found out that I was allergic to peanuts on the floor of an extended session classroom at Wilshire Baptist Church in 1979. And so from there, we were, for mom and dad, we were just really there all the time. We were there Sunday mornings, Sunday nights. Remember we had Sunday night church? I did not like Sunday night church when I was growing up. I did not understand why we had to go twice. I thought we already heard that stuff in the morning. And then every Wednesday night we were there for choir and handbells and what we called mission friends back in those days. So just around the church a lot. And I think I made a profession of faith when I was 11 years old on Christmas morning in 1988. Kind of went down to the front, and Bruce McKeever was the pastor, my pastor growing up at Wilshire, who some of you may know who that is. He was there for 33 years, I think, and had already retired, but someone else had joined the church that day, and so Bruce stepped out of the pew, and I was the last person that Bruce sort of welcomed into the church in his first role as pastor emeritus, and then was baptized a couple months later on the first Sunday in February, and what I remember about that is that there was an ice storm in Dallas that day, and the church had no power and therefore no heat in the baptistry. So it was a chilly in and out. It was not a baptism by fire. It was a baptism by very cold. It was a very quick in and out. You know, I think I said Jesus is Lord and then went under and then came right back out. So
that's commitment, though.
Yeah,
that's
good. Right.
Well, now talk to us a little bit about school. I imagine you're a pretty good student. Talk to us about your school years, what subjects you were drawn to, that sort of thing in your school years.
Yeah. I guess I was an okay student, I think. That was stressed for both of my parents, who are from different parts of the country, were valedictorians. And so that was a lot to live up to. And so they never expected us to be valedictorians, but they both happened to be that. And so, studying and learning and really being a lifelong learner is, I think, a value for us as a family. So I really liked early on. I was good at math, really enjoyed science, and loved kind of music in elementary school and junior high and high school. In high school, spent lots of time, doing choir and musicals and doing theater productions and stuff like that. So,
talk to us a little bit about what role music played in your life. It sounded like it was a big part, but how did that start? What did you listen to? I guess it was in your family if your parents were playing. Talk to us a little bit about how you were drawn to that and how your own talent developed.
Yeah. Dad is he was a doctor, but he's also an avocational, very good one, organist and pianist. And so we were just surrounded by music, mostly classical music growing up is what I really remember. I started taking piano at 8. I studied it very seriously all the way through, really through high school and into college a little bit. The whole wake up at 5 a.m. and practice a couple hours and then go to school and then have lessons in the afternoon and that kind of stuff. But I think music, I just don't remember a part of my life when music wasn't around, or was it when it wasn't something I thought about, at least later in life as a career. For a long time, I said two things growing up. One, I will never work in a church, and two, I will never be a music major. And both of those things, God had other plans. So,
talk to us a little bit about that, waking up and I mean, I bet you're doing, contests, mm-hmm. and rehearsals just all the time. Was there a part of you that said, okay, are you getting tired of this? Did it light you up when you're young or?
Yeah, it's a combination of all three of those things. So it wasn't, I wanted to stop taking piano multiple times especially when I was in junior high, when I was an adolescent. You get to a point where you're kind of rubbing against your parents all the time. And so, I didn't understand why I was being forced to take piano. I'm really glad I was being forced to take piano, because it taught me a whole lot more than just, the notes on the page. But I think it was more of just learning a discipline, learning the activity of, every day you get up and you do something and you produce something, was really important.
And were you more of a craftsman or more kind of creative, or what sort of was your style as you're learning piano?
As a musician?
Yeah.
Just the notes on the page. Like, no, I am not, unlike my father-in-law, who is a really gifted, he can play by ear. I cannot play by ear. I mean, I have to have the roadmap. That's just the way that I'm wired. Now I will take the roadmap and be creative with it and do things dynamically and things like that. I don't play the piano much anymore, so I'm glad the piano's back there covered up. I think that's, to me, it was always more about, that was part of what excited me about music was the mathematics of it and the theory of it and the formula of it. So,
was there a moment, whether it's with a music teacher or a teacher in school or maybe your parents or a minister, that you really kind of a lesson, a life lesson early on that made an impact on you?
So my piano teacher was really, really great, and she demanded excellence in a very loving and grace-filled environment. But that doesn't mean that she ever accepted excuses. I think the thing that I learned, there wasn't ever a phrase or anything like that, but the thing that I learned the most from my piano teacher is that no matter what happens, the music doesn't stop. So you don't get to stop. If you make a mistake, you figure it out and you keep going. And I think that can be applied to almost anything in our lives. You know, for us on Sunday morning, if something, this doesn't ever happen here, but if something goes wrong in worship doesn't just stop, right? You have to keep moving ahead. And so I think that was a really good one. The other one was my theater teacher in high school, was named Nancy Pointer, who was outstanding and very much a taskmaster. And I remember we were in her seventh period theater class, which was sort of the advanced theater class. And there was one of the people in the class who was upset that they didn't get a role in a play. And she looked at the person and said, "You must remember that life is the audition." And so this is a kid who had missed a bunch of class and wasn't paying attention and thought that just by being good at reading a part would get something. And I think the life is the audition thing has stuck with me forever. And that is that, you know, you are always being held to a standard, you know, whether it's your own or someone else's standard. And you just have to remember that, you know, it helped me through college and through grad school and all of that. So
let's talk about college. You went to the University of Texas.
I did.
I know that's made a big impact in your life. Talk to us a little bit about that transition, moving from Dallas to Austin, beginning to study, figuring out what you're going to do with your life. I know there was a transition time for you there. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I loved UT. I didn't set out to go to UT, and I didn't grow up a UT fan at all. I auditioned at several schools to be a piano performance major. And when I went for the audition at UT, there was just something different about the campus and the environment and the city and the bigness of it that drew me to it. It felt like a place that felt very different from our high school growing up. And I really fell in love with it. And so started out there as a piano performance major, did not last more than a year doing that. My very first lesson with my private professor, she said, "Now, you know, I only really expect 6 to 8 hours of practice a day from my undergraduates." So I paused. And I had really been, I had gotten busy as a senior, and so in high school, and so I had gone from practicing a couple hours a day to a couple hours like every other day, but was still able to fake it. And this was not a place where, you know, you could fake it. So I kind of quickly realized I don't know that I really want to spend 6 to 8 hours a day in a practice room by myself, because one of the things I love about music is making music with other people. At the same time, I had, you know, was in the choir and was making a whole lot of friends in choir. So I kind of bounced around within the music school, but I started as piano performance. I switched my major to theory and composition, wasn't really good at that, and then finally found a home in choral conducting because had a couple of really good professors, and it was a really good choral program there. So,
and you're more involved with other people, but talk to us a little bit about how that is to kind of change your path or your planned path out a little bit, whether it's psychologically, spiritually, or practically. What did that look like? I remember in law school, this may not be the same, but in law school, I remember my first year of law school, you know, I thought I was going to, you know, just, this is going to be easy, you know, I'll knock this out. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm not the smartest guy in the room anymore. So
definitely.
It did. It's like psychologically kind of changes you and changes your direction. Did you have something like that?
I did. That's really interesting. So like when I thought, like anyone who's 18 does, that I was pretty good at stuff. And then I got to college and realized, oh, everybody here is as good or better than me. And one of the things I really liked, and it also was a signal to me that piano was not the path for me, was it was a very international piano program. So students from Korea, from China, from Japan, from all over the world, who had spent a whole lot of money and time and effort to try to get into this school in the United States, and were far more motivated to practice 6 to 8 hours a day in the practice room than I was. And so I think that was it's part of what I loved about Texas. Like I said, the bigness of the program, the level of competition that was healthy, and kind of thinking to myself, okay, this is not the path I'm going to go down. One of the benefits to a large music program like that is that there were several options for me, and all of those departments were good departments. It wasn't a school that was just good at one thing. And so that was really, you know, really helpful in sort of setting the next several years of my life, I think.
And before we leave Austin, talk to us a little bit about what, I guess, University of Texas has meant to you since that time. You seem very connected to it still in terms of sports, in terms of, you know, just that loyalty and support of the school. Talk to us a little bit about what UT means to you.
Yeah, well, they certainly think I'm connected. They ask me for money twice a month. Y'all know what that's about. I still have lots of dear friends there. We try to go to maybe one or two games. Margaret went to Baylor. She's a trooper. She'll go to Austin with me. Really, it's more about just what is helpful about these days and our communication these days is that I can watch a game at home, but start a big text thread with all of my friends, and we can mostly complain about what the coach is doing. As we're just watching it. So there's that kind of connection. But anytime I go back, you know, Austin has changed a whole bunch. It changed a lot in the 8 years that I lived there, and it has certainly changed in the 15 years since I've been gone.
It's still weird.
It is still weird. although now it's more of a California high-tech weird and not a Central Texas, you know, barbecue weird, which is what it was, I think, back a few years ago. And so I think, you know, the connection is just feeling, I got 2 degrees from the university. So I got my bachelor's and master's degree there. I spent a lot of time there and really just have a lot of fondness for the institution. One day I'll give them a little more money. But, yeah.
Someday. Well, where'd you go next? What was your first job upon leaving Austin? Talk to us a little bit about what you did next.
The very first job was teaching elementary music, general music to kindergarten through fifth graders. In Austin. So I graduated with my bachelor's and got a job teaching, which was really fun. I really, really enjoyed it, and it was a good year. And during that year, felt even more of a conviction that what I really wanted to do was ultimately be a music education professor. And so I had known that I was going to go back to grad school. I just didn't know exactly when, and I knew that I kind of wanted to really focus more on the research side and the learning side of music, how we learn music and how our brains learn it. And so I did that I taught for a year and then went back to grad school to get a master's in choral conducting and in music education. And my research focus was the changing male voice between the ages of 12 and 14 or 15 or sometimes 16. And so that was really interesting, too. In the middle of that, I was home in Dallas for a week in the summer. And George Mason at Wilshire had just begun the pastoral residency program there, and he and I were having coffee, and he said, "Have you ever thought about music ministry?" And I said, "You know, George, I've always said I'll never work in a church, and I'll never, you know, whatever." I said, "No, I really haven't thought about music ministry at all." And he said, "Well, would you consider after grad school maybe coming and trying and being our first music ministry resident?" And you know, I thought about it for several months, and then said, "Yeah, sure, I'll do that," and did, and then now I've sort of serpentined my way to.
Well, did you feel a calling at that time toward the ministry, and walk us into what that residency program was?
I think so. I had a conversation with George, and I asked him this question. I said, "What's the difference between a calling and just a really good idea?" And you know, his response was, you know, calling is something that you know it when it happens to you and you feel like you can't live without it. And at that point, I didn't feel like that was the only thing that I could do in my life. I think it was those two and a half years in that residency program, which was incredibly vital to what I feel like is my ministry today, learning how a church works. Learning how, and not just the music side of church, but every aspect of church, and learning how to minister to the people and work alongside, you know, the congregation, seeing things that, you know, positives and negative things that would happen in the course of that church, where we weren't the ones who were ultimately responsible for the decisions, but we got to learn alongside those who were. That really shaped me a lot. And so I think my sense of calling to this work has really been a very gradual, long arc over the years that I've been doing this. So it was not a kind of here's the light moment, and this is what you should do. Yeah.
That sounds like a great program, and I understand you met a lot of people through that program that are still your friends. Talk to us a little bit about how you've maintained the connection with Wilshire and some of the people in particular?
Yeah, we were so there are about I think there are 27 residents that are currently placed somewhere around the country. Most of them are pastors. Some of them are doing other kinds of adult ministry work. I'm the lone church administrator out there, and there are a couple of music ministers out there. Every year there's a reunion, so we all get back together in Dallas. And it's really neat. They put this map up, and you see where everyone has gone to. So we have folks like my sister in Denver. My sister was also a resident, by the way. Folks like us in Houston. What's really unique, as you all know here, there have been now four people who have intersected with South Main and the Wilshire residency. So Amy Grizzle Kane, myself, Tim Peoples, and Kevin Sinclair, Gardner Sinclair. So there's the, you know, Wilshire and South Main are very much sister churches and very much, you know, kindred in this I-45 pipeline. And so I think for us, it's really a great way to reconnect. And it's kind of, Steve has a, some of you may know, has a group called Metro, where local pastors get together and just have a good time of kind of friendship and professional development, all that. The residency reunion has become our version of that. And it's really good to get back together with everybody and check in and see how their families are, but also to say, okay, here's something that's happening at my church. Help me work through this. We've said this before, but I'll publicly say it again. The budget companion that we now hand out every January, that color page thing with the pretty pictures and the words that Greg writes, is an idea that I just completely stole from another resident who is doing it over in Georgia. So Scott Dickison is a colleague and resident who is at the First Baptist Church of Christ in Macon, Georgia. And they started doing that, and he showed it to us, and I took it, and now there's several people that are doing that. It's really just those kinds of ideas are the things that we gain from that. So it was not a 2-year thing, and then we stop. I mean, it's been a long kind of collegial relationship.
Continue to have some great benefits from it. And speaking of benefits from it, how did you meet Margaret?
Water first. Margaret and I met at John and Nancy's ranch in Bowie, Texas. Bowie is an hour north of Fort Worth. We were there in the fall of 2007 for Amy Then Grizzle's 30th birthday party and Andrew Darty, another friend of ours in the residency, his 30th birthday party. So to make a long story as concise as I can, Beth Emerson, who attended South Main while her husband Jordan was in med school, Beth and I and my sister, we all grew up together. Our families were best friends. We did the Disney World thing, whatever. And at this point in my life, I was about 30 and still not married and not looking like I was going to get married anytime soon, which apparently was concerning to Beth. So Beth claims that she orchestrated this whole party because there were a lot of people that wanted to come into Dallas to do this thing, and it happened to be at a time in the fall that was natural. And Beth said, ah, I know a guy at South Main that has a ranch close to Dallas. Let's have the party there. And so I had not met Margaret. I had not met John and Nancy. I was just an innocent guest at this party. And that's where we met, and we hit it off, and the rest is history.
That's great. That's great. Backing up just a little bit, after you left Wilshire, you were already at Cliff Temple then when you met Margaret.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about your time at Cliff Temple in Dallas. What were the challenges that you faced there? And some of your duties and maybe how that morphed into more than just music.
Yeah. Cliff Temple is a great church. It is in the North Oak Cliff neighborhood of Dallas. And if you know anything about Dallas, that's a neighborhood that's gone through a lot of transition. It used to be in the 30s and 40s was a very wealthy section of town. There are some beautiful old homes there. A lot of things in the city changed politically, and it sort of went down and is now on the rise back up. Cliff Temple is a church that at its height had 5,500 members, and that was in the 30s and 40s. It had one pastor from 1918 to 1966. It's a long time to have one pastor. Since then, they have not had a pastor for more than 10 years. And that's not the church's fault, and that's not the pastor's fault. It's just sort of, when you have one leader for that long, it's hard for any place to sort of understand, particularly a leader who was there at the zenith of the church.
Kind of a founder issue.
Yeah, really. And so it was a great church. I found out about it nearing the end of my residency. Their minister of music had been there 34 years. His name was Bud Lovell. Bud was retiring, in December of 07. And so Glenn, who was the pastor at the time, called me in December and said, look, I don't see why we can't just have you here first Sunday of January ready to go. And I said, well, Glenn, I can think of 34 reasons why I probably shouldn't just show up on the very first Sunday after your beloved minister of music had retired. So I sort of had to ask them for an interim and an interview process, just so there were some other people besides, you know, Glenn weighing in on this. That all worked fine. And when I got there, Glenn had become ill the previous summer. And so for my first 8 months or so, there was a time where I was every single Sunday was planning worship with a different pulpit supply. And so it was not really what I was used to. At Wilshire, it's much more like it is here, where you all sit around the table and the pastor's there and the minister of music are there and all the residents are there at Wilshire. And here we are all seven around the table. It was me by myself, sort of. I would get a text sometimes on the Wednesday before, if I was lucky, just from whoever. And it was really hard to get a cohesive thing going. But the choir was great. They were very supportive. And, you know, it was a time in the life of the church where Glenn's illness coupled with some folks in the church who were just really unhappy with, frankly, with his leadership. And so very early on, I saw some pretty significant church conflict. And the result of all of that is that Glenn resigned about 11 months after I started there, which, you know, was the best thing for all of the people involved. And so then we had an interim for about 18 months as we searched for a pastor. And it was during that interim that we discovered several things that were happening. One of them was that the bookkeeping at the church just was not being kept. And so what looked like on a financial statement, what looked like, this was in August, I will never forget this, it was in August of 2008, what looked like about a $200,000 deficit to date was really $650,000. Once we discovered that, we also discovered several things, like our annuities hadn't been paid into. There were bundles of undeposited checks and cash in drawers, just snowed under, right? And so as a result of that, the bookkeeper and the church administrator at the time were let go. And you have to understand, $600,000 to us is like, yeah, it's November, right? But to them, on a $1.5 million budget, that's a lot of money. And so it was, for me, there were two things that happened. One is I got my resume ready because I did not have enough faith to think that the doors of the church weren't going to close by the end of the year. It was almost insurmountable. The other thing that happened is that the interim pastor asked me if I would fill in and do some administrative duties for a time being. And I started doing that and did, and was very fortunate to be surrounded by some lay folks who are really, really good accountants and CPAs in their own right, and who helped us all clean up the books and figure out where the money needed to go and what it needed to be. And then Cliff Temple was blessed with a couple of families who really just swooped in and saved the church for that year. And once we got that kind of turned around, that's really where I first started to understand the importance of transparency as a church family when you talk about your money together. Because we, at some point, somebody decided to stop being transparent, and all of a sudden that church was $600,000 in the hole. And that's really not the way it needs to be. And so that really galvanized my philosophy of church finance and of generosity and all of that. So yeah.
It's really cool to see when you tell us these stories to see the characteristics that you carry through your work life and your life here, to see, okay, that's where that came from. That's really, really great. Well, connect us from there at Cliff Temple to now, or not necessarily to now, but to the time that you came to South Main. Talk to us about the experience of coming to South Main. How did that work?
Well, I had gotten to a point after doing the admin thing. So my title eventually became permanently the Minister of Music and Administration. which a lot of people think is unusual, but you'll remember that Phil Martin started his career as a music minister, and Tom Williams started his career as a music minister as well. So at least at this church, there's a history of we get all trained up in music, and then we decide to just look at the numbers, I guess. You know, I got to a point where I was honestly doing 80% administration in my daily tasks and 20% music, and liking it. You know, it wasn't a begrudging 80%. It was just, this really feels more like what I want to do. I like having a role in supporting all of the ministries of the church and facilitating all of those ministries, in seeing how, you know, that was really the first time that I fully understood the importance of corporate and congregational giving and generosity, that this collection of gifts can do an amazing amount more than any one of them could do on their own. And so I really felt that that was a shift in which not only had my calling to ministry cemented, my calling to church administration really fell in line. And so I believe it was 2003, I got a phone call from Steve mentioning that Tom was going to retire and he wanted to have a conversation. So we had a couple of conversations about that. And I'd known Steve for many years. Steve knows George, and it's all, you have to understand, the CBF world is a pretty small, you know, the circles aren't very large. Y'all are aware of this. And so we first had a conversation in 2013. You know, we clicked really well. I do, now I kind of laugh at the fact that he told me at the time, you know, if this all works out, we'll be looking at putting in a new organ right after you would arrive. And we think it's going to be about $1.5 million capital project. It's, you know, no big deal. And I was like, okay, that's fine. I mean, I can, you know, we can manage that. And lo and behold, $12 million later, here we are with this really incredible, incredible place. But I think, you know, Margaret and I were married at South Main. And so I'd heard of South Main my whole entire life growing up. The first time I came here was right before we got married. Then we got married here. The South Main had always held a place in my heart, even though it was in Houston. And so, you know, that was the hardest part about coming here is, you know, if only it weren't in Houston, then, you know. But I think that that really it was a natural fit for us. So,
well, in the meantime, you and Margaret have started a family. Tell us a little bit about your kids, William and Jack. What do they like? What do they not like? What do you expect them to do with their lives from what you've seen here in the last few years?
Right now, I hope they make it to kindergarten. William is 5. Jack is 3. William loves routine and order. No idea where he gets that from. He loves learning. He loves reading. You know, he is really, he loves being the one who is right in school. So we're working on that with him. I wrote this down, and this is completely off the record, but if I had to guess at William's trajectory, I would guess that he will either be a lawyer or a veterinarian at this point. But that's such a terrible guess. I mean, I really have no idea. I just know that he's very bright. He loves music. He'll start playing he's going to go to Parker Elementary, where Margaret teaches, which is a music magnet. And so he'll start doing violin next year, which is pretty cool as part of their magnet program. Jack is 3, very different personality. He's a little more laid back. He's funny. He's silly. He loves the color green. Yesterday in Sunday school, they made a Mother's Day card where they made a heart out of their handprints. Every child's handprints were red, except Jack's, who were green. So Jack asked Mr. Bill and Miss Missy if he could make his green. He loves his Uncle Jonathan, my brother-in-law, Margaret's sister's husband, who is a rancher. And I really think all signs are pointing to Jack wanting to work on a ranch. I mean, he just absolutely loves horses and cows and tractors and hay, and cleaning out a stall with Jonathan. Like all the stuff that, you know, just makes you think either something's wrong or something's very right with where he's going to go. So
that's great. Well, while we're on this, tell us about Margaret and Parker and some of the, I guess, the some good things that have happened in her life there.
Yeah, Margaret is these what's called PPCD, the PALS program. It is basically preschool special ed. So they do early intervention with 3- and 4-year-olds who show signs of learning disabilities, and they try to kind of intervene early so that they can get on a better foot starting kindergarten. It is truly a calling for sure. In 2017, she was awarded the HISD Elementary Teacher of the Year, which was a really high honor for her. And, you know, she was really surprised by it, but I don't think any of us were. And it was really cool. I mean, we got to meet the superintendent, and you get to do all of these fun things. And then we went on to the Region 4 kind of ceremony. Region 4? Is it Region 4? Yeah, I'm looking at Bill. It's Region 4, right? And so that was really neat. So she's done really, really well there. Her principal is leaving at the end of this year, which is a good thing, a career change. And so she's also on the committee to select the new principal. So she's really involved there.
And what about being a part of the larger McCoy clan nowadays? What is that like?
Well, I met Margaret in the fall, and then really quickly went back for her grandmother's funeral about 3 weeks later. And so I hadn't even met John at this point, because John, at the time that Margaret and I met, John was retiring from Pogo and was sort of doing all that he needed to do to get out the door. And it, as you know, John, it killed him that he wasn't there that weekend that we met. But her grandmother passed away. I went back to Bowie for this funeral, and we were at the viewing, and there were 50 to 60 people just sort of all like they knew each other milling about in this viewing. And I leaned to Mark and I said, "Now, which ones of these are your family?" And she said, "All of them." I was like, "That's not possible." I had three cousins, one on my dad's side and two on my mom's side. And both sets of grandparents lived 500 miles, one in Mississippi, one down in South Texas. And so this concept of a large family was completely new to me and a little overwhelming. And so I you know, learned their names pretty quickly and, got to know them, and really they, as an extended family, have been more than welcoming to me. In fact, I've done a wedding for them, and I've done a funeral for them and all of that. So it's kind of, I guess I'm the family minister at this point now. But with John and Nancy specifically, I joke with people, honestly, I hit the in-law jackpot. And I think we both did. Both sets of our parents love being together. Mom and Dad will come up to we're going to go up to the ranch over Memorial Day weekend, and Mom and Dad are going to drive up, and we all spend time together. And I'm aware that that's not always the case, and that there are lots of jokes about in-laws and all of that. But I really feel like, you know, it's just I feel as much a part of their family as, you know, I think they feel a part of ours. So it's very special.
Well, and Brad and I, sometimes we got to lunch together. I'm always learning something interesting. He tells me an article to read or a podcast to listen to, something like that. Brad, tell us a little bit about some of the things that you're most interested in, whether they're hobbies. I know you cook a lot. You're just interested in a lot of things. Tell the group here about some of the things that are most sort of compelling in your life that you're drawn to.
I do like to cook. I like to barbecue a lot. I've gotten into smoking brisket, which is really hard, which is what I like about it. Excuse me. I play golf really poorly, but I like to play and love watching, you know, Texas sports and stuff like that. I think the thing that draws me to cooking is that I remember cooking with my grandparents and my mom growing up, and just learning how to do that and being in the kitchen. We're trying to do the same thing with William and Jack. You know, they want to help, and so we're finding the little jobs that are appropriate and safe for them to do. The thing about food, it's similar to music to me, and that is that you really know a culture well if you understand and appreciate their music and their food. And they're sort of those universal languages. And so because of that, I just like that. I like trying new things. I like doing other things. There are three things that I do not eat. They are meatloaf, carrot cake, and bread pudding. And these are simple rules for you to live by. Meat should not be in a loaf. Loaves are for bread. Carrots should not be in cake, and I just don't think bread should be in pudding. So those are my three little... Everybody's going to joke that I'm picky. I'm really not picky. It's just those three things, especially meatloaf. I don't care for squash too much either, but.
Okay. Talk to us a little about the church in general, like what you think church is for, and how do you think South Main kind of connects with those, I guess, ideals or what God has put the church in the world for?
To me, the thing that sets the church apart from other institutions and nonprofit groups trying to do good and affect good change in the world is really that it's an intergenerational institution. And that is unique. If you remember, if you were at the 1120 service yesterday, there was a family dedication, and you're watching an infant not being paraded around the room, but actually being prayed for as Steve traveled with Owen through the room. And to look out, I was in the choir yesterday for a one-time only deal that I promised Susan and Arlene I would do. And so I was looking out and just to see the faces, all of your faces, the faces of folks who are in our Sunday school class, the faces of the youth, that's a really unique thing, and it's very special. I think South Main does that just about as well as anybody I know. We like it. We embrace it. We like to be with each other across all ages. It's unique in the nonprofit world in that it's the place where all of the people who are invested in the institution know each other and care about each other. They don't just see each other once a year at a dinner or an event, but they see each other every single week, and they're all contributing and giving their time and their money to mission efforts, to discipleship efforts, to deacon visitation, to things that really make the church work. And so it's just this network of people that are connected in a way that I think is really special. And I think it's the spiritual nature of what we do that kind of binds us together.
And in particular with your duties, with your responsibilities of seeing how funds and resources come into the church, being a part of the staff, talking about ministry, talking about missions, that sort of thing, you're sort of in a unique position to see how, in a sense, money and resources comes in, it becomes ministry, and hopefully it becomes transformational. I think I asked you this at the State of the Church, but talk to us a little bit about how you see funding and resources become transformation on the ground.
Well, I think my desk is unique in that I get to see requests for big amounts of money, like fixing the Loessner roof, come across my desk, and for really little amounts of money. And both of those things have equal weight. Both of them have a impact on our ministry, and I love that. I love the variety of things that I see. I said this at State of the Church, but I get to sign expense reports every week, and my favorite ones to sign are the ones when the family ministry expenses come in. And so a couple weeks ago, there was a $7.50 expense for Brandon Adney, who had bought Raising Cane's for a youth and taken it to him at school and sat and eaten lunch with him. Leanne Bryant had bought supplies for the Maine Kids musical, $22 worth of stuff. Kate Lane had gone out and taken a new young mom to coffee for just a time to catch up and counsel. And so I think those are the things where it's a tiny little thing, and I look at it and I make sure that it matches, and I make sure that, you know, what the numbers here are the same as the numbers here, and it's all adding up. But what I'm really seeing is, again, the freedom of our gifts being used to go out into the world. Our gifts that aren't designated, it's just here to the church and here to God's kingdom is this pile of money, and we go and do good.
Yeah. And from everyone, it's remarkable to be in that position to see that. And it really does make a difference. Just, going out to see a kid's football game and, bringing something. It's just remarkable. You do see that transformation. It sets these kids on a different path, and it shows them that the church loves them and cares for them. There's one thing that I see on Sunday morning. I talked to Damon Ankeman about this, is that when something, it doesn't happen much, right? When something goes wrong here at South Main. But when it happens in my area, I think people see me rushing around with anxiety on my face. That does not seem to happen to you. And I love this about Brad, that if he's got this great poker face, this great kind of calming, just shows composure in every circumstance. You talked a little bit about a lesson that you learned when you were young, but how do you pull that off?
I think I've thought about this question a lot, and I think I trace it back to, I mentioned that Dad was an ER doctor in a very busy emergency department. And I remember at a very young age, he never came home and talked about what he saw, because that would have not been good for little kids to hear. But what I remember him saying was, you know, we're not allowed to run when we're in the hospital. Because Dad walked very, very fast. Everywhere he went, he would walk fast. And so they had a rule in their department that there's no running, because that just leads to more chaos and anxiety. And the other thing is, you know, here's a person who would see on a daily basis the worst crisis of every single patient's life is happening on that day in that moment. And he walks into the room, and panic just isn't becoming. It's not helping anything. And so I think he is a lot better at it and was better at it than I probably will ever be. But I think that left something to me about, you know, when a problem happens or a challenge happens, you can, you know, you can get panicked about it, or you can just try to manage the anxiety and diffuse the situation and do your best. And I think that, you know, short of an emergency, most of what goes wrong here at the church is either fixable or it's kind of not that big of a deal in the grand scheme of things. But you know, I try to have a little perspective on that. Yeah, you know,
that's good for me to hear. I think there's something about. But there's something about confidence, too, I think. I see when I coach Little League, a kid would strike out, and he would, you know, throw his helmet down. You know, I think he was trying to convey, hey, I care, and I know I'm better than this, and I can do better than this. I want y'all all to know that. And I think even when I'm walking fast or have some anxiety in my face, I think I'm trying to convey, hey, folks, I know something's wrong, and I'm here to fix it. But you've got this confidence to say, you know, it's going to get taken care of. I'm going to handle it. I don't need y'all to know.
Nothing to see here. Everybody calm down.
Well, there's something very attractive about your ability to have composure in those situations that I think we could all learn from a lot.
I think this is funny because, so there are things that happen in my daily life where I think, oh, this is a big deal. Like I need, and usually the first person I go to is Greg. It is such a gift that Greg maintains his law license for us and offices right next to me. And I can just walk in and say, all right, should I panic about this or not? And 90% of the time he's like, no, it's fine. You know, and that's what he does. So behind the office door, Greg is the calming force,
well,
I think,
that's
for all
good
of us.
To hear. Let's switch gears a little bit just to kind of close here. I know everyone's probably getting hungry and our food's almost ready. Is some of those interesting things about you. What are you listening to right now? Whether it's a podcast, what are you watching on Netflix? What are you interested in our culture now that maybe you want people to hear about or know about?
Margaret and I love documentaries, so we're watching a lot of documentaries on Netflix. There's one, if you have Netflix right now, called 7 Days Out that I really recommend. It is about, it takes, I can't remember how many, maybe 6 or 7 events, the Kentucky Derby, the end of the Cassini mission at NASA. And it starts at the very end and works backwards the week prior to all of that. And so what I love about that is, you know, a lot of what we do here is we'll have an event coming up or a program coming up. And it's that final week, that final push to get everything done. So that's really, really interesting. I recommend it. I watch Game of Thrones. Margaret does not.
You don't like the dragons? No dragons.
Any of it. No dragons, no any of that kind of stuff. You know, podcast-wise, I listen to Freakonomics Radio a lot, which is good. We're listening to a podcast right now called The Whistleblower. It's about the Theranos startup company in Silicon Valley. I don't know if you know about it, but it was a woman who claimed that you could run 200 blood tests on a single drop of blood and got a bunch of investors to believe in it and all that. It's really, really interesting. So that kind of stuff I like a lot. And then I do share with you, I read a lot of long-form journalism articles, you know, magazine articles that take you 30, 45 minutes to read, just because I like to dig into a particular niche in history. I shared one with Greg about a year ago about a guy just going across the Arctic by himself, you know, and it was just this, when they're really well-written, I mean, you feel enveloped in that. So that's kind of how I spend my free time.
It's an experience. What's ahead for you in this church with your family? Talk to us a little bit about your future, and we'll close there.
Well, again, we're hoping the boys make it to kindergarten, so that's next.
Short term.
Yeah, short term. You know, I think this is really our home, and we want to be here for as long as God allows and as long as we feel like it's a good fit. It is really great to be in a church like this and to raise 2 boys in this church, so we don't want to go anywhere. And I think for the church, we're really in an incredibly healthy place. You know, it is, you have to understand, my experience at Cliff Temple was very different, and it was very refreshing to come to a place that knew how to handle conflict and handle it well. And so no matter what happens here or what happens across the street, we're poised to be here for another 100 years because of the people who are in this church.
That's great. Brad, thank you for all your words of wisdom, advice, sharing with us about your life. Really appreciate it. It's so good to work with you. Thanks.